Welcome, and thank you all for attending. My name is Morris Hittery. I'm president of Congregation Beth Torah here in Brooklyn, Concerning Sephardic Congregation, here for well over 40 years. It is our privilege tonight to welcome and host Rabbi Professor Jonathan Sacks, and of course his wife, Julie. Rabbi Sacks is the chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregation of the UK, and has held that post for over a decade. The chief rabbi holds a doctorate in divinity and honorary doctorate from at least 8 other universities. The rabbi is a gifted speaker and has received distinguished awards, including the Jerusalem Prize in 1995. The rabbi appears frequently on radio and TV and has written 14 books. His latest book, The Dignity of Difference, will be the subject of tonight's talk. The book, by the way, as you know, is on sale for $10 everywhere. Tonight's lecture has been brought here by the Center for Sephardic Heritage. This organization promotes Sephardic heritage, culture, music, and work of prominent writers, and publishes a fine weekly newspaper. I'd like to introduce for a second the director of the Sephardic Heritage Center, Mr. David Shasha.
On behalf of the Center for Sephardic Heritage, we express our deepest thanks and gratitude to the rabbis and officers of Congregation Beth Torah. We're very proud to be working with Congregation Beth Torah doing this, this very, very special lecture. In the year 1901, a very important book was published in Italy. The book was called Israel and Humanity. The book was written by probably one of the last great exponents of the Sephardic tradition, Rabbi Eliyahu ben Amozev. The book was a plea for tolerance, pluralism within a strictly Orthodox Jewish context. The book, unfortunately, is not very well known. And when last August we received the first extract of Rabbi Sacks' masterwork, the work that will, like Rabbi Ben Amozev's work, transcend centuries, because it speaks to the heart of the human condition within a specifically Jewish context. When we received the first extract of this book, I was absolutely flabbergasted that such a profoundly intelligent and sensitive work could be published at a time of great difficulty for all of us. By promoting the ideas of pluralism and tolerance within, again, a specifically Jewish Orthodox perspective, with the idea that Jewish particularity and Jewish identity is central to our way of life, and yet is part of a larger context, a larger world that exists out there, that is not alien to Judaism. These words move me deeply, and I trust that in presenting the ideas in this book tonight, Rabbi Sacks will move you as much as he moved me on that day in August when I first read his words. Ladies and gentlemen, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks.
Wonderful community of Beit Torah and in a program of your splendid center for the Sephardic heritage to be here with you in Shasha. It's a great honor. I'm afraid we're a little jet lagged. It's now 2 o'clock in the morning English time, and therefore I'm always reminded at such moments of the wonderful English story of the man who dreamt he was giving a speech in the House of Lords and woke up to find that he was. But may I say, by way of introduction, the particular and quite specific delight I have in being with you. I am an Ashkenazi, I confess. And what an enormous debt we owe, firstly to the great Sephardi heritage of the Golden Age, to those wonderful, wonderful poets, and mystics, and philosophers, and halakhis, Yudah Levi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, above all, Ramban Moses Maimonides, whose 800th Yad cycle we'll observe next year. And indeed, in more recent times, not just the fascinating role that David Shasha mentioned, Rabbi Eli Ben Amozek, but also as great Rishon LeZion holders of Chief Rabbi, Sephardi Chief Rabbi of Israel, the great Ben Zion Uziel of blessed memory, Rabbi Ben Chaim Lachaim, and Rabbi Levadia Yosef, Rabbi Bakshi Doron, can you hear?
Rabbi, could you make it a little louder?
A little louder?
Yes.
Oh, I can do that. I must say, I'm reminded of the occasion when, is that okay? That's good?
Yeah.
When somebody shouted out from the back of the room, can you speak a little louder? I can't hear. And somebody in the front said, I can hear. Would you like to change places with me? And I congratulate the Sephardi community in your new Rishon LeZion, Rav Amar, who's a very fine and generous and tolerant man, as Bakshi Doron was as well. And I think we should all, us Ashkenazim, aspire to become honorary Sephardi. Let me begin with a story that just amuses me. You see, I used to be, before I became a rabbi, a philosopher. And I also am still chief rabbi of Hong Kong, even though it is gone back to China. So I love the story about the English philosophy professor who was invited to give a philosophy lecture in the University of Beijing. Not being a fluent speaker of Mandarin, he had to arrange for a Chinese interpreter and translator. Well, he began his lecture in front of the assembled academics, a very complicated lecture on metaphysics and epistemology, and after the first sentence stopped so that the translator could translate his remarks into Chinese. But the Chinese interpreter said, carry on, and I'll tell you when I need you to stop. Well, he carried on for 15 minutes. And then the interpreter said, wait a second, and said four words in Chinese, I'm not very good at that. Oh, I can't. For one, then wait for him to continue. He spoke for another 15 minutes, the interpreter said stop, and he said another four words to the audience. 45 minutes, stopped, said another four words, and at the end of the hour's lecture, he said three words to the audience. All the assembled Chinese philosophers got up and filed away from the room, and the English philosopher said to the Chinese interpreter and said, I'm astonished. I gave a very complex and difficult lecture. How were you able to summarize it in so few words? Very simple, said the Chinese interpreter. After 15 minutes, I said, so far, he hasn't said anything.
follow 45 minutes, I said, I don't think he's going to say it. And after 60 minutes, I said, I was right. But you understand that to attempt to say something new about one of the oldest problems in mankind, and certainly in Jewish history, is difficult. But that is what I want to try and do this evening. Just the effort to think about something new, in something very old in a new way. And here it is. We have a very difficult, tense world. I will explain at the end of the lecture what this has to do with us. But first, let me just explain the basic idea of the book, Dignity. We have, my beloved, a very difficult, intense situation in the world. You see, if there was one thing that united every prophet of Europe and the Enlightenment from the 18th century onwards, is that they believed that religion would die out, disappear. We'd all become rational, secular, and so on. Religion, at best, would be marginal, mild, and altogether malleable. We would become secular. And therefore, there is one thing no one expected, that in the 21st century, we should see re-emergence of religion as a major factor in international politics. Whether 9/11, or Afghanistan, or Iran, or the conflict in Kashmir, in Chechnya, the Balkans, Northern Ireland, the Middle East. All of a sudden, religion has become an extremely important factor in those conflict zones. Not that religion is the cause of conflict, but it's very often the fault line around which the sides divide. For instance, the Balkans, Kosovo, and Bosnia, are divided into three groups. Catholic Croats, the Russian Orthodox Serbs, and the Muslims. And it's very interesting that all those people, all those three groups, belong to the same race. They speak the same language. And the only thing, as one commentator said, the only thing that divides them is religion, which none of them believe. The religion isn't the cause of conflict, but it is the line along which sides divide. And therefore the question is, can we think of a way of thinking about religion and identity strong enough to avoid some of the terrible conflicts that lie ahead? Why are they so serious? I think the reason is that all of a sudden a number of things have happened in the world. Perhaps the most important one is that until recently, for most people lived among people who were like them. I know that doesn't apply in Brooklyn, but it applies in most parts of the world. You live with people who have the same religion, the same history, the same culture, same background, and therefore you didn't really have to deal with the people who are not like you. Today, through travel, through television, through internet, through emails, we are confronted with sheer diversity all the time. We are constantly living with people not like us. The question is, how do you deal with that fact? And for many countries and cultures in the world, the answer is with great difficulty. People don't like people who are different. And that creates conflicts. It created conflict. The last time we had a conflict like the serious conflict like the one we have in the 21st century was in 16th and 17th century Europe. After the Reformation in 1517, between then and the Treaty of Westphalia in 1646, Europe was riven by wars, civil wars, and factions, Protestants, Catholics, Holy Roman Empire, local rulers, for over 100 years. And the end result of that was that two doctrines were formed. One in England, one in America. in England, there was a philosopher called John Locke, who advanced the doctrine of what he called toleration, what we call tolerance. In America, Tom Jefferson, First Amendment, separation of churches. Those were the ways of bringing peace to countries which had populations of different religious groups to stop them fighting with one another. And those doctrines, strong enough to help us in the 21st century? The answer is no. Why? Because, first of all, separation of church and state or tolerance applies within one country. It's based on the fact that there is a government strong enough to stop groups fighting if they do fight. That was great in one country, but within the globe as a whole, we have no global government strong enough to stop sides fighting. And secondly, because tolerance is not something that every religious believer naturally believes. That makes sense to you? You tell people to be tolerant, some people like the fine weakness of belief, of compromise, and all sorts of things. And therefore I searched for an idea that might be strong enough to face the 21st century. And I want to explain it in the following way. There are two responses to living with religion. One, which goes back to the early history of humanity, is called tribalism. You see that each little group is a tribe, and the world is divided into my tribe against yours, or my nation against yours, or my God against yours. And that, of course, is the situation in the ancient world, where there were, each nation had its own gods, who belonged to this particular people, that particular place, and they used to fight one another. Nowadays, we have tribalism in, you'll forgive me, I'm a Britisher, so I don't understand this, your baseball thing, right? That's the survival of tribalism, warring tribes. And of course, the end result of that is war, and the end result of that is massive loss of life. So you see, somebody came up with another idea. A Greek philosopher called Plato lived 2,400 years ago. And that is this, that everything that's local, tribal, particular, is not really truth. If you want to understand truth, you have to understand what's universal, what applies to everyone, in every place, in every time. And that is the Western answer to tribalism in the universe. And what really, really worried me when I thought about my current situation is that universalism is as dangerous as what it is. Why? Because if there is only one truth for all people, for all time, then if I am right, you are wrong. And if you are wrong and I am right, I am entitled to convert you, to conquer you, or if need be, to kill you in the name of that truth. And this, from this flows centuries of exiles and inquisitions and persecutions of human beings killing other human beings in the name of God. Therefore, universalism also seems to be. That is why I went back to the Bible. The first 12 chapters of Bereshit, to read it again and see if we could discover something new, something interesting. And here it is. Heaven, what is Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, about? It is about one nation called the Jewish people. One man, Abraham, one family, Abram and Sarah, who become a tribe, then a collection of tribes, then a nation. That is what the Tanakh is about, the history of this people and their tempestuous love affair with the Almighty. But ask me, does the Torah begin with the Jewish people? The answer is no. The answer is no, because the first 11 chapters of the Bible are about Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Noah and the flood, Babel and its builders,
universal archetypes. None of those are Jewish. They never heard of Lev Israel, whatever makes you Jewish here in Brooklyn. These were universal rights. The Almighty makes the covenant with Noah, which applies to all mankind, and only then does he move to the particular, to Abraham, and says, Abraham, I want you to be different. Leave your home, your birthplace, your father's house, and go to the land I will travel to show you, be different. Therefore, the Torah has something rather special. It has a universal dimension, but also a particular dimension. The question is why? I think the answer is quite simple. The Almighty said to Avraham Avinu, be different because I want humanity to understand the importance of being able to be different. Does anyone remember the story that immediately precedes the call of Avraham Avinu? But immediately before Lazarus is the last thing we read. The story of the Tower of Babel, a picture of which, a rather nice one you see on the front cover of the book. What was Babel about? Let me tell you, Babel was the first global project before Coca-Cola, MTV, internet. Babel was the first global project by he, Kalahat, Safar, Chaz, Varim, Achadim. The whole world spoke one language and the same words. It was a global project. And of course, you remember the Almighty came down and said, no, I don't want this. And he went down and confused their languages. So every time somebody said to somebody, pass me a brick, they gave him a cup of coffee. Every time he said, give me a cup of coffee, to you, or whatever it was, and the whole thing collapsed. What is going on in this story? The answer, I think, is this. And here I follow two great commentators, Jewish commentators, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch from Frankfurt, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin from the Yeshiva of Volozhin, who said that Babel was the first attempt to create a society in which everyone thought the same way. A totalitarian society. And what is wrong about that is that actually God wants us to be able to be different. One unlike another, one having an argument with them. The Almighty wants us to be different. He does not want us to impose uniformity on all mankind. Judaism begins as a protest against imperialism, against totalitarianism, against what nowadays we recall in a religious context, fundamentalism. What is common to all those three things is that they are an attempt a single opinion on the world. The Almighty therefore splits up mankind into many languages and tells Abraham, I want you and your children to the end of time to be different, to show humanity that I value difference. And that is the simple argument, in a nutshell, of the dignity of difference. As you can imagine, it's a bit more complicated than that, or I wouldn't have written the other pages. That is simple. Now I want to explain to you why I wrote the book. You see, I didn't say this in the book at all, so you'll have an advantage to everyone else who ever read the book and wonder why I wrote it. I'll tell you. Trevor, you remember what we said in the Haggadah just a few days ago on Facebook about that? Remember when it comes to that, what it says. It wasn't
one alone, Pharaoh in Egypt, who stood against us to destroy us. But in every generation they rise up against us and try to destroy us. I've got to tell you, when I was growing up, I didn't know what those words meant. I never experienced that in Tennessee. I didn't know when I sat as a child at the Seder table, I thought to myself, this is my parents' generation and their parents' generation. My father, Oliver Shalom, came from Poland, a little town called Kielce.
Do you know what's special about Kielce? Kielce was the town, unspeakably,
that conducted a pogrom against Jews in 1946, a full year after the Holocaust. They killed, murdered hundreds of Holocaust survivors. You don't get more anti-Semitic than Kielce. It's the moment when my father was ever driving and he saw a red, they came up against a red light, red traffic light, you would always say,
anti-Semitic traffic.
And I, in my innocence, thought until a little over a year ago, that was all in the past. I grew up without anti-Semitism. Now let me tell you, last Pesach, Pesach a year ago.
Here it is, Pesach a year ago. Remember?
Yidden are sitting down to begin the Seder in the Park Hotel in Netanya. Rachmana Litzlan, a suicide bomber, kills 29 people, injures hundreds of others. Our Pesach night, as they're sitting down to make a Seder. I and Elena and I and our family were making Pesach in Italy. During Chol HaMoed, news came through that five shuls in France had been firebombed over Pesach, one in Marseille burnt to the ground. In Italy, do you remember what was happening last Pesach? The Israeli government were laying siege to the Church of the Holy Nativity in Bethlehem because a number of Palestinian gunmen were taking refuge there. I don't know if you know, but when they got the gunmen out, the Israelis went in to make sure that there was nothing left behind that could harm the priests in that church. You know, they discovered 40 explosive devices hidden there to kill the priest who had given them refuge. Now, I will tell you, there is a very distinguished Italian newspaper called La Stampa. And during Chol HaMoed Pesach, La Stampa carried a cartoon of a little baby Jesus in a cot surrounded by Israeli soldiers with machine guns, and the line underneath it said, "They are crucifying." And I thought, the Haggadah is right and I'm wrong. We are living to see the emergence of a new anti-Semitism that I never thought I would see in my life. And therefore I decided that we have to fight against this with dignity, with tolerance, with generosity of mind, but we have to fight it. And the question I asked myself, why do they? And of course, on this question, the origins of anti-Semitism, hundreds, maybe thousands of books have been written. However, there is one answer that strikes me as so fundamental, so inclusive, it includes every other explanation, that it seems to me to get to the heart of that. Who would you count as the first anti-Semite? Second anti-Semite. Obviously, Haman Arasha, the first person who planned genocide against Haman, Haman of Purim, who planned who planned to wipe out the Jewish people in one day. What did he say to King Ahasuerus? There is, Your Majesty, one people scattered across all the nations, and their laws are different from those of any other nation. Why do people not like Jews? It is what is called the dislike of the unlike. Jews were hated because they were. Ah, you will say, every people is different. That is true. However, Jews were throughout Jewish history. unusual in that more than any other people, they lived and were prepared to die for the right to be different, for the duty to be different, for the dignity of difference. There have been five universal civilizations in the course of Western history. Civilizations that tried to impose their values on all the nations they conquered. What were they? The Greek Empire of Alexander the Great, the Roman Empire, medieval Christianity, medieval Islam, and European Enlightenment. All of those five civilizations attacked the Jews. The Greeks in the days of Antiochus IV, which we recall in the festival of Hanukkah. The Romans, by destroying Korban by Cheney, destroying the Second Temple, and by the devastating decrees of Emperor Hadrian when he suppressed the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Medieval Christianity and Islam, a whole history of forced conversions, inquisitions, expulsions, auto da fe, ghettos, pogroms, and the European Enlightenment, which gave rise to the modern racial anti-Semitism and culminated in the terrible denouement of the Shoah. Why? The answer is that almost alone of the religious and ethnic minorities, almost alone, Jews were the people who refused to assimilate to the dominant culture, who refused to convert to the dominant faith. They insisted on the right to be different. That is why anti-Semitism. That is why when I wanted to fight against anti-Semitism and all forms of racism and prejudice, I had to prove the dignity of difference. We have to have the right to be different. Friends, what do we do with this new anti-Semitism coming from many cultures, from Islam, from mainland Europe, from all sorts of things? What do we have to do? What should be our job? I have three answers. Number one, the first thing we must do is never, ever to be intimidated. I want to tell you a little story. You know that in Russia, under Mikhail Gorbachev, that process known as Glasnost, which opened up Russian society, had some very good news for the Jewish people. It allowed Jews to be free to be Jews in a way that they hadn't been for 70 years. That was good news. The bad news was that anti-Semites were allowed to give voice to anti-Semitic sentiments in a way that they hadn't for 70 years. One of my rabbinical colleagues in Manchester went out to Russia in the late 80s to help the reconstruction of Jewish life. He was, actually looked like a Brooklyn rough. He had a big black hat, big long black beard and a kapot. And he was there working with the Jewish community in Moscow, and one day, a young lady came to, see him in great distress. She said, "Rabbi, what can I do? All these years..."
Oh. Rabbi Lieberman.
Honorable. Lovely to see you, Rabbi.
Okay.
Rabbi Lieberman, I will summarize the story so far. We are in Russia in the late 1980s, and a young lady has come to see a rabbi, very distressed. She says, "Rabbi, what shall I do? All my life, I hid the fact that I was Jewish. And nobody ever commented, nobody ever said anything to me. But now when I walk in the streets, they shout at me, 'Jid, Jid, Jew, Jew, what should I do?'" And the rabbi said to a young lady, "If you hadn't told me you were Jewish, I wouldn't have known. But me, he had your hadras panim." He said, he had a long beard and he looked like your wonderful rav. And he said, "Me, they probably don't think I'm an Episcopalian." And yet, said, when I walk in the street, they don't shout, Jew, Jew. Why do you think that is?
The young lady thought, and she said, well, you know, they probably know that if they shout Jew at me, I will take that as an insult. But if they shout Jew at you, they know you'll take that as a compliment. So that is the first thing we must do. Always walk tall and be proud to be Jew, and never ever be intimidated by anti-Semites. Number two, what do we have to say to the anti-Semites? Let me tell you something. I think we have to be honest and say to the anti-Semites, Hevel, you think you're hurting us, you are hurting yourselves. Shall I tell you something? Anti-Semitism may be the world's oldest hatred, it is also the world's oldest excuse for tyranny, despotism, the denial of human rights. Why? Because if you have corrupt or totalitarian regimes, you condemn a population to suffering and lack of freedom. And the population don't like that, and they rise in rebellion. And the only way you can keep yourself in power is to say it's the powerful, it's the fullest, them. And Jews have always been the them that they appointed. That is why every act of anti-Semitism, even though it hurts us, hurts those who give voice to it, no less. If you look at any country today where anti-Semitism is part of official state doctrine, you will find that country is a country of poverty, of ignorance, of lack of freedom, of government corruption, and everyone therefore who gives credence to anti-Semitism is perpetuating a society in which they are hurt even more than we are. You remember when Pharaoh refused to let the people go, his counselors said, Haperem teda ki ovda Mitzrayim. Don't you realize you're trying to destroy the Jews, you're actually destroying your own country. And that is happening throughout the Middle East. Countries which are the wealthiest in the world in terms of natural resources, gas, oil, liquid gold, they have riches beyond belief. What is the condition of the people? Poor, ignorant, subject to disease. Anti-Semitism, hatred, hurts the hater every much as that which he hates. And we have to say that to the anti-Semites. Let go of that hate if you want to have any future for your own children. Thirdly, however, we have to say this to humanity as a whole. Jews were hated and still are because they were and are different. But being different isn't something peculiar to Jews. It is what makes us human. You know, there's a wonderful Mishnah in chapter 4 of Sanhedrin which says, when a human being mints coins, you have a United Synagogue, United States, United States Treasury, they mint dollar coins, or quarter cent, half cent, 25 cent coins. A coin comes out exactly the same. If you mint many coins in one mint, they all come out the same. The Almighty mints every human being in the same image, His image, and we all come out different. The Almighty respects different. And therefore, the challenge is to see God's image in someone who isn't my image, whose religion and language and culture are different from mine. He too, or she too, is B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God. And therefore we have to say to humanity, anti-Semitism may begin with Jews, it never ends with Jews. If a country has no room for Jews, it has no room for difference. If it has no room for difference, it has no room for humanity. And therefore when we fight anti-Semitism, we don't only fight it on behalf of the Jewish people we fight it on behalf of what makes us human. Hevra, that is why I tried to write a book, to
tell non-Jew, I mean, I hope you'll read it and enjoy it, right? Wrote it really for the wider public to say, accept it. This cannot continue. Jews may be different, but all of us have to recognize the dignity of it. And I hope that this new approach will generate some response. It actually already has. Christian and Muslim thinkers, it has had a wonderfully warm response. And of course, that is basically the story of the book I tried to write. However, I will just end with two stories which are very powerful. One I simply tell, this has been a long time now, so it was last in Brooklyn. Am I right that Eastern Parkway is also in Brooklyn? Is that right? When I was a kid, I came here and I met a very great man. Some of you may have met him, called the Lubavitch Rebbe, bless him. That meeting changed my life. I hadn't dreamt of becoming a rabbi until I met the Lubavitch Rebbe. And I tell you, you know, the Rebbe told me to stay on a little bit, a few weeks, so that I could. And I stayed in 770, or a house near to 770 Eastern Parkway, and I spent several weeks, you know, in the yeshiva, and I got very, very drawn to Hasidus. However, I also have to tell you, in those days, I was a university student, and I thought to myself, hang on, if I become a Hasid, what happens to all the things I love, like Shakespeare, like Beethoven, like, you know, all the things that don't obviously go with being a Chabad Chassid. So I wrote a little letter to the Rebbe saying, I'm very drawn to this, but surely I'll have to give up everything non-Jewish in the culture around. Do you know what? The Rebbe wrote me back a letter in his own handwriting. He did not even do this. In the form of a mashal, a little story. The Chassidim were very excited because they hadn't seen the Rebbe do this. And it is the story with which the book ends, and I'm going to tell you the story. He said, imagine two people who earn a living by schlepping. They both carry stones, that's their livelihood. Only different kinds of stones. One carries rocks, building material, the other one carries diamonds. That's what they do for a living. He says, give each of them a bag of emeralds. How are they going to respond? The Rebbe says, the one who slaps rocks, gets a bag, he says, another heavy weight. The one who carries diamonds, there are such things in this world as precious stones. He looks at the emeralds and he says, oh, they're not diamonds, but they're also precious stones. He said, so it is with faith. If for you religion is just like a heavy weight alone, then somebody else's religion will also seem to you like a heavy load. You don't care about yours, you won't care about his. But if you know that your religion, your faith is diamonds, is precious stones, then when somebody shows you emeralds, you say to yourself, well, that's not my faith, they're not diamonds. They're different, but they're also precious. He said, the more you value your own Yiddish guy, the more you will value other people's faith as well. They're emeralds, they're not diamonds, but you will value them all. So, on the contrary, he said, it won't be that you will appreciate Shakespeare and Beethoven less, you'll appreciate them more. And I've got to tell you, there are few Rabbanim who would say such a thing. That was a great statement by one of the greatest human beings that any of us will have had the privilege of meeting, and that was the first story. So if you are confident in your own faith, you're not threatened by somebody who's different. I end with another story which is much more frivolous. But, you know, on a miserable subject, the day after Yom HaShoah, I end on a slightly more cheerful note. Many, many years ago, long before I became chief rabbi, long ago, have any of you been in London in winter? Even worse, you know, a New York winter. New York winter, that's serious. A London winter is just plain miserable, you know? And so we had one of these awful, miserable winters, and I said to Elaine, we've never been anywhere sunny in the winter. Let's go and see, get some winter sun. And he said, what about, neither of us had ever been to Elat. Had you been to Elat? We'd never been there before. So we decided we'd go to Elat. It's warm in the winter. We'll get a little winter sun, cheer us up. And the members of my shul said, Rabbi Sachs, please don't go to Elat.
It's not Rabbi.
It's not Rabbi. It's not the kind of place a rabbi should go. It's not sneer. It's not known for its modesty of attire. Well, we ignored the remark and we went anyway, and you know what? They were right. I had to go everywhere without my glasses. And I finally said to them, what's a rabbi-ish thing you could do? You know, what is there in the lab, which is at least reasonably okay, you know. So we found the one thing you can do in Elat, which is not immodest, which is they have glass-bottomed boats. Well, you go out and you see all the lovely, pretty fish. And we went out on this glass-bottomed boat. We were the only passengers on the boat. So we were talking English, and the captain of the boat heard us speaking. He rushed over and he said, "Attend the Anglia, you're from England?" We said, "Yes, why do you ask?" "Ah," he said, "we have just come back. I've just come back from spending a holiday in England." Now, you know what Elat is like. It's the middle of the desert. It's surrounded by brown, barren hills. It's a very desert kind of place. Anyway, we said to him, "How did you like England?" He said, "Wonderful! The buildings, so old! The grass, so green! The people, so polite!" And then an enormous smile came over his face. And he looked around at the wilderness of Elat. And he said, "About the sun. But this is now." Friends, there are other cultures, other civilizations, other things. They're all beautiful. About the sun. We don't need to negate anyone else's faith to be proud of our own. Let us therefore be proud of our differences. Let us use those differences to enrich the world. Let us pray that hatred can be supplanted by shalom and Israel. Amen.
Rabbi has a few minutes. Anybody has any questions? He'll be happy for a couple of minutes to take some questions. So,
could you speak loudly? Yeah.
Yes. My name is Susan Aronoff. I want to change the focus a little bit to what's happened in the production, and that is now we're within our own community, not necessarily outside of the community. I'm a member of the state called Women for Wall, and we are a group that practices a lot of prayer, which is practiced in any Orthodox synagogue in the world. But we are barred from praying in the hotel, according to our custom. And I'd like to hear your comments about the problem of religious power in the hotel.
I'm sure you know the wonderful story. It's one of my favorites. I heard it from the grace of the wife of our version, and I'll still share it with you. A newcomer arrived in a little community, and you know, he rides in and makes his home in this new town, and on the first Shabbos goes to shul, and is welcomed with enormous warmth. He's so thrilled to be made part of the community, and everything about this community is delightful. Until it gets to Kriyat HaTorah, to the reading of the Torah. Now, you know that there's a difference of opinion when it it comes to the reading of the Torah, some people hold that you have to sit during reading of the Torah, some people have to hold you have to stand. Well, in this particular shul, half the shul stood, half the shul sat. And the ones who were standing were saying to the ones who were sitting, oh, my life is open your mouth, that during Kriyas HaTorah, you have to stand. And the ones who were sitting were saying, I'll be Gosim, that, you know, during Kriyas HaTorah, you have to sit. And they were trying gavolt at one another, and this was driving the guy mad. Anyway, Kriyas HaTorah finished, peace reigned again, and so on. The next week, the same thing happened, and the week after, the same thing. And finally, the newcomer couldn't bear it anymore. Why in the Islamic community did they have this hour of Brigis in the middle of Kriyas HaTorah? There wasn't a rabbi in the shul, so he traveled to the nearest town where there was a rav. He came into the rav was sitting in a study surrounded by volumes and shas and poiskim and all the sources you could imagine. And he said, Rabbi, you have to solve this problem for me. Yet, we bring out the Torah and we read from it, is it the rule that we have to stand? And the rabbi shakes his head and says, no, that is not the tradition. Ah, says Rabbi, in that case, when we read the Torah, do you have to sit? And the rabbi says, no, that is not the tradition. And the man says, but you've got to help me. In my shul, a half stand, half sit, and they're all trying to vote at one another. And the rabbi nods and says, yeah, that is the Baruch Hashem, when you ask about the internal conflict that you introduced now, I think we leave it there. I hear what you're saying. May I tell you a story? I will tell you a story. You know, when you're chief rabbi in England, you become a little bit of a public figure for the non-Jews as well as Jews. It's a very weird thing, I don't know exactly how to explain it. We have a very famous newspaper called the Daily Telegraph. It's our best-selling serious paper, our best-selling broadsheet. And for 5 years in a row, when it came up to the 25th of December, instead of doing something on the Archbishop of Canterbury, they did a full-page profile of the chief rabbi. Why? I don't know why. Every year I said to my wife, they probably forgot they did it the year before, but they did it 5 years running. Anyway, the last time they did it, which was 2 years ago, they sent an interview, lovely knowledge, on every conceivable aspect, and it went very well. And I thought, oh, Christ, well, I flipped on any banana. We all do from time to time, but this gave me didn't. Just the following time. He said, if Prince Charles and Camilla were Jews, would you marry him in your And I gave him the following answer, which was printed in the paper verbatim. I would not have become chief rabbi. I could not avoid answering the question.
Excellent. First of all, I'd like to say that I read your book and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Yes, sorry about that. How do you reconcile the idea of absolute evil and the idea of evil in the world? How do you bridge that within your philosophy of the dignity of difference? And how do you reconcile the idea of Judaism, strict red lines against, idolatry, things of that nature? How do you reconcile those things?
You see, absolute evil is the very basis of what we call the universal code that applies to everyone. And that, of course, is what we call the Sheva Mitzvot, the Neyach, the Seven Noach Laws, which are culminate, which reach their climax, in the sixth verse of the ninth chapter of Bereishit, in those extraordinary words, Shofet Dam Ha'adam
Ba'adam, Damo, Ishafei, Ibitaran,
Mokim, Asai, Ba'adam. He who sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, because God made mankind in his own image.
In other words,
God said there are evils which are not only crimes
against humanity, but crimes against the murder of a human being, God forbid. That is inexcusable. That is absolute.
And that is why absolutely
is all part of universal covenant. It's not special to Jews. I mean, if somebody that would be evil, it must be forbidden to everyone, not just to one.
Secondly, Amalek. Do you want me to specifically deal with Amalek?
Not specifically Amalek, but the idea of certain people, like you say, there is universal evil,
yeah.
And it is identified. How do we deal with such a thing on a global basis where philosophy is a consideration?
Well, look, let me just deal with Amalek, okay? Because I think this is relevant to the present situation. It is particularly relevant to the awful, unprecedented assault been mounted against Israel since September 29, 2000. You know, I'm sure you know this, but, you know, in England we only see in the papers that one of the tragic suicide bombing yesterday. In England it's only reported for really big tragedies. But of course, for instance, if you follow, let's say, the Jerusalem Post on the internet, you see on the site, breaking news, hijacked, attack after attack after attack. And I suddenly realized after a few weeks that there were so many more attacks than we knew of. And I remember asking the Israeli government to give me official statistics. And do you know, when I asked, which was already a couple of months ago, since September 29, 2000,
more than 15,000 terrorists. Arithmetic are not far short
of one every hour of every day of every week for 2.5 years. And what is the result of it? Israel suffered. My own 19-year-old nephew, a yeshiva student, had to attend on one morning the funeral of his three closest friends. Five of them were gunned down as they were sitting learning Gemara.